enough to re-secure the tape through the gap before I closed the door behind me. I checked my watch, allowing myself 30 minutes for the search. I figured if a neighbor had observed me breaking in, it would take the LA cops at least that long to respond to the call. The interior was dim. Mickey's curtains were drawn, and sunlight was further blocked by the 6-story building across the alley. Mickey still smoked. Stale fumes hung in the air, having permeated the carpet, the drapes, and all the heavy upholstered furniture. I checked the cigarette butts that had been left in the ashtrays, along with an array of wooden kitchen matches. All were the same Camel filters he'd been smoking for years, and none bore the telltale red rim suggesting female companionship. An Elmore Leonard paperback had been left on the arm of the sofa, open at the midpoint. Mickey had introduced me to Elmore Leonard and Len Dayton. In turn, I told him about Dick Francis, though I'd never known if he'd read the British author with the same pleasure I did. The walls were done in a temporary-looking pine paneling that was nearly sticky with the residue of cigarette tars. The living room and dining room formed an L. The furniture was clumsy, big, overstuffed pieces of the sort you'd buy at a flea market or pick off the sidewalk like an alley fairy on collection day. There was a shredder against one wall, but the bin had been emptied. In Mickey's view of the world, no scrap of paper, no receipt, no piece of correspondence should go into the trash without being scissored into tiny pieces. He probably dumped the bin at frequent intervals, using more than one trash can, so that a thief breaking in wouldn't have the means to reassemble vital documents. No doubt about it, the man was nuts. I moved into the dining area, past 4 mismatched chairs and a plain wooden table that was littered with mail. I paused, picking through the stack that was piled at one end. I was careful not to sort the envelopes, though my natural inclination was to separate the bills from the junk. I spotted a number of bank statements, but there were no personal letters, no catalogs, no credit card bills. I had little interest in his utility bills. What did I care how much electricity he used? I longed for a phone bill, but there was none to be found. I knew the cops had lifted those. I picked up the handful of bank statements and slipped them down the front of my jeans into my underpants, where they formed a crackling paper girdle. I'd look at them later when I was home again. None of the other bills seemed useful, so I left them where they were. Best to keep the federal mail tampering convictions to a minimum. Off the dining area, I entered a galley-style kitchen so small I could reach the far wall in 2 steps. Stove, apartment-sized refrigerator, sink, microwave oven. The only kitchen window was small and looked out onto the alley. On the counter, he kept a round glass fishbowl into which he tossed his extra packets of matches at the end of the night, a road map of his journey from bar to bar. The upper cabinets revealed a modest collection of melamine plates and coffee mugs, plus the basic staples, dry cereal, powdered milk, sugar, a few condiments, paper napkins, and 2 sealed bottles of early times bourbon. The cupboards below were packed back to front with canned goods, soups, beans, spam, tuna packed in oil, tamales, SpaghettiOs, applesauce, evaporated milk. In the storage space under the kitchen sink, I found an empty bourbon bottle in the trash. Tucked in among the pipes, I counted 10 5-gallon containers of bottled water. This was Mickey's survival stock in case the next war broke out or L.A. was invaded by extraterrestrials. The refrigerator was filled with things that didn't smell right. Mickey had tossed in half-eaten items without the proper wrapping, which resulted in dark chunks of hardening cheddar cheese, a greening potato covered with wart-like sprouts, and half an air-dried tomato drawing in on itself. I retraced my steps. To the left of the living room was the door to the bedroom with a closet and undersized bath beyond. The chest of drawers was filled with the usual jockey shorts and t-shirts, socks, handkerchiefs. The bed table drawer contained some interesting items. A woman's diaphragm and a small spray bottle of cologne with a partial price label on the bottom. The cologne had apparently been purchased from a Robinson's department store since I could still make out a portion of the name. I removed the top and took a whiff. Heavy on the lily of the valley, which I remembered from the early days of our romance. Mickey's mother must have worn something similar. I remembered how he'd lay his lips in the hollow of my throat when I was wearing it myself. I put the cologne bottle down. There was a tissue paper packet about the size of a stick of gum. I unfolded the paper and picked up a thin gold chain threaded through the clasp of a small gold heart locket with an ever-so-tiny rose enameled in the center. Not to sound cynical, but Mickey'd given me one just like this about a week into our affair. Some men do that, find a piece of shtick that works once, the gift of a single red rose, and recycle the same gesture with every woman who comes along. In a cleaning bag, he'd hung two dark blue uniforms with patches on the sleeves. I slid a hand up under the bag and checked one of the light blue patches. Pacific Coast Security was stitched in gold around the rim. Also hanging in the closet were a couple of sport coats, six dress shirts, four pairs of blue jeans, two pairs of chinos, a pair of dark pants, and black leather jacket I knew very well indeed. This was the jacket Mickey wore the first time we went out. The same jacket he was wearing when he kissed me the first time. I was still living with Aunt Jin, so there was no way we could go inside to misbehave. Mickey backed me up against the trailer door, the leather in his jacket making a characteristic creaking sound. The kiss went on so long we both sank down along the frame. I was Eva Marie Saint with Marlon Brando on the waterfront, which is still one of the best screen kisses in recorded history. Not like love scenes nowadays where you watch the guy stick his tongue down the girl's throat trying to activate her gag reflex. Mickey and I might have made love right there on the doorstep, except we'd have been visible to everybody in the trailer park, which we knew was bad form, making us vulnerable to arrest. I shook my head and closed the closet door while a sexual shiver ran down my frame. I tried the door next to it, which seemed to be an exit onto the rear gallery. The lock here was new. There was no key in the deadbolt, but it probably wasn't far. Mickey wouldn't make it easy for someone breaking into the apartment, but he'd want the key handy in case of fire or earthquake. I pivoted, letting my gaze move across the area, remembering his tricks. I knelt and felt my way along the edge of the carpeting. When I reached the corner, I gave the loosened carpet a tug. I lifted that section and plucked the key from its hiding place. I unlocked the back door and left it temporarily ajar. I went back to the bedroom door and stood there, looking out at the living room. The cops had doubtless cruised through here once, sealing the apartment afterwards, pending a more thorough investigation. I tried to see the place as they had, and then I looked at it again from personal experience. With Mickey, the question wasn't so much what was visible as what wasn't. This was a man who lived in a constant state of readiness, and as nearly as I could tell, his fears had only accelerated in the past 14 years. In the absence of global conflict, he lived in anticipation of civil insurrection, unruly hordes who would overrun the building, breaking into every unit, clamoring for food, water, and other valuables like toilet paper. So where were his weapons? How did he intend to defend himself? I tried the kitchen first, tapping along the baseboards for the sound of hollow spaces. I'd seen him install other safes, compartments with false fronts where you could tuck cash, guns, and ammunition. I started with the kitchen sink. I took out all the gallon water containers, exposing the floor and rear wall of stained plywood. I shone the penlight from top to bottom, side to side. I could see four screw heads, one set in each corner, darkened to match the panel. I unbuckled my fanny pack, opened my mini toolkit, took out a battery-operated drill and set about removing screws. A person could develop carpal tunnel syndrome doing this the old-fashioned way. Once the screws were out, the partition yielded to gentle pressure, exposing a space that was 6 to 8 inches deep. Four handguns were mounted in small racks on the rear wall along with boxes of ammunition. I replaced the panel with care and continued my search. At the end of 30 minutes, I'd uncovered three small recesses hollowed out behind the switch plates in the living room. Each contained a packet of identification papers, birth certificate, driver's license, social security card, along with credit cards and currency. Emmett Vanover, Delbert Ambergee, Clyde Byler? None were names I recognized, and I assumed he'd invented them or borrowed them from deceased persons whose vitals he'd gleaned from public records. In every bogus document, Mickey's photo had been inserted. For the moment, I left everything where it was and moved on. The paneling, while cheap, turned out to be securely fastened to the walls. But I did find tight rolls of crisp $20 bills tucked in either end of the big metal curtain rods in the living room and dining rooms. A quick count suggested close to $1,200. In the bathroom, I had removed a length of PVC, 2 inches in diameter, that had been set into the wall adjacent to the water lines. The pipe contained a handful of gold coins. Again, I left the stash where it was and carefully realigned the pipe in its original site. I'd also discovered that the back of the couch could be removed to reveal a space large enough to hide in. The only place I bombed out was one of his favorites, that being down the bathtub drain. He liked to drill a hole in the rubber stopper and run chain up through the plug. He'd attach the relevant item to the chain, which he then left dangling down the drain with all the slimy hair and soap scum. This was usually where he kept his safe deposit key. I took a minute to lean over the rim of the tub. The rubber stopper was attached by a chain to the overflow outlet, but when I flashed the light into the drain itself, there was nothing hanging down the hole. Well, shoot. I consoled myself with the fact that I'd otherwise done well. Mickey probably had other secret repositories, maybe new ones I hadn't even thought about, but this was the best I could do in the time allotted. For now, it was time to clear the premises. I let myself out the back door using Mickey's key to lock the door behind me. I slipped the key in my pocket, stripped off my rubber gloves, and zipped them into my pack. I went downstairs and knocked at the manager's front door. I'd assumed that B and C Hatfield were a married couple, but the occupants turned out to be sisters. The woman who opened the door had to be in her 80s.
Yes?
She was heavy through the middle with a generously weighted bosom. She wore a sleeveless cotton dress with half the color washed away. The fabric reminded me of old quilts, a flower sacking floral print in tones of pale blue and pink. Her breasts were pillowy, powdered with talcum, like two domes of bread dough proofing in a bowl. Her upper arms were soft, and I could see her stockings were rolled down below her knees. She wore slippers with a half moon cut out of one to accommodate her bunion. I said, "Mrs. Hatfield?"
"I'm Cordia," she said cautiously. "May I help you?"
"I hope so. I'd like to talk to you about Mickey Magruder, the tenant in 2H. She fixed me with a pair of watery blue eyes.
"He was shot last week."
"I'm aware of that. I just came from the hospital where I was visiting him."
"Are you the police detective?"
"I'm an old friend." She stared at me, her blue eyes penetrating. "Well, actually, I'm his ex-wife," I amended in response to her gaze.
"I saw you park in the alley while I was sweeping out the laundry room."
I said,
"Ah." "Was everything in order?"
"Where?"
2H, Mr. Magruder's place. You were up there quite a while, 32 minutes by my watch."
"Fine, no problem. Of course, I didn't go in."
"No?"
"There was crime scene tape across the door," I said.
"Place was posted, too. Big police warning about the penalties."
I saw that. She waited. I would have continued, but my mind was blank. My thought process had shorted out, catching me in the space between truth and lies. I felt like an actor who's forgotten her lines. I couldn't for the life of me think what to say next.
"Are you interested in renting?" she prompted.
"Renting?"
"Apartment 2H? I assume that's why you went up."
Oh, sure. Good plan. I like the area."
"You do? Well, perhaps we could let you know if the unit becomes available. Would you care to come in and complete an application? You seem discombobulated. Perhaps a drink of water."
"I'd appreciate that." I entered the apartment, stepping directly into the kitchen. I felt like I'd stepped into another world. Chicken was stewing on the back of the stove. A second woman, roughly the same age, sat at a round oak table with a deck of cards. To my right, I could see a formal dining room, mahogany table and chairs, with a matching hutch stacked with dishes. Clearly, the floor plan was entirely different from Mickey's. The temperature on the thermostat must have been set at 80, and the TV on the kitchen counter was blaring stock market quotes at top volume. Neither Cordia nor her sister seemed to be watching the screen.
"I'll get you the application," she said. "This is my sister, Belmira."
On second thought, why don't I take the application home with me? I can fill it out and send it back. It'll be simpler that way.
Suit yourself. Have a seat.
I pulled out a chair and sat down across from Belmira, who was shuffling a tarot deck. Cordia went to the kitchen sink and let the faucet water run cold before she filled a glass. She handed me the water and then crossed to a kitchen drawer where she extracted an application. She returned to her seat, handed me the paper, and picked up a length of multicolored knitting, 6 inches wide and at least 15 inches long. I took my time with the water. I made a study of the application, trying to compose myself. What was wrong with me? My career as a liar was being seriously undermined. Meanwhile, neither sister questioned my lingering presence. Cordia said,
"Belmira claims she's a witch, though you couldn't prove it by me."
She peered toward the dining room.
"Dorothy's around here someplace. Where'd she go, Bell? I haven't seen her for an hour."
"She's in the bathroom," Bell said, and then turned to me. "I didn't catch your name, dear."
"Oh, sorry. I'm Kinsey. Nice meeting you."
"Nice to meet you, too."
Her hair was sparse, a flyaway white with lots of pink scalp showing through. Under her dark print house dress, her shoulders were narrow and bony, her wrists as flat and thin as the handles on 2 soup ladles.
"How are you today?" she said shyly, as she pulled the tarot deck together.
4 of her teeth were gold. "I'm fine. What about yourself?"
"I'm real good."
She plucked a card from the deck and held it up, showing me the face.
"The Page of Swords. That's you,"
Cordia said.
"Belle!"
"Well, it's true. This is the second time I pulled it. I shuffled the deck and drew this as soon as she stepped in, and then I drew it again."
"Well, draw something else. She's not interested."
I said, "Tell me about your names. Those are new to me." Belle said,
"Mother made ours up. There were 6 of us girls, and she named us in alphabetical order. Amelia, Belmira, Cordia, Dorothy, Edith, and Fay. Cordy and I are the last 2 left."
"What about Dorothy?"
"She'll be along soon. She loves company."
Cordia said,
"Belle will start telling your fortune any minute now. I'm warning you, once she gets on it, it's hard to get her off. Just ignore her, that's what I do. You don't have to worry about hurting her feelings."
"Yes, she does," Belle said feebly.
"Are you good at telling fortunes?" Cordia cut in.
"Not especially, but even a blind hog comes across an acorn now and then."
She had taken up her knitting, which she held to the light, her head tilted slightly as the needles tucked in and out. The narrow piece of knitting trailed halfway down her front.
"I'm making a knee wrap, in case you're wondering."
My Aunt Jen taught me to knit when I was 6 years old, probably to distract me in the early evening hours. She claimed it was a skill that fostered patience and eye-hand coordination. Now, as I watched, I could see that Cordia had dropped a few stitches about 6 rows back. The loops, like tiny sailors washed overboard, were receding in the wake of the knitting as each new row was added. I was about to mention it when a large white cat appeared in the doorway. She had a flat Persian face. She stopped when she saw me and stared in apparent wonderment. I'd seen a cat like that once before, long-haired, pure white, 1 green eye and 1 blue. Belle smiled at the sight of her.
"Here she is."
"That's Dorothy," Cordia said. "We call her Dort for short. Do you believe in reincarnation?"
I've never sorted that one through.
"We hadn't either till this kitty came along. Dorothy always swore she'd be in touch with us from the other side. Told us for years she'd find a way to come back. Then, lo and behold, the neighbor's cat had a litter the very day she passed on. This was the only female, and she looks just like Dort. The white hair, the one blue eye, the one green. Same personality, same behavior. Sociable, pushy, independent.
Belle chimed in.
The cat even passes wind the way Dorothy did. Silent but deadly. Sometimes we have to get up and leave the room.
I pointed to the knitting. It looks like you dropped some stitches. I leaned forward and touched a finger to the errant loops. If you have a crochet hook, I can coax them up the line for you.
Would you? I'd like that. Your eyes are bound to be better than mine.
Cordia bent over and reached into her knitting bag.
Let's see what I've got here. Will this do?
She offered me a J-hook. That's perfect. While I began the slow task of working the drop stitches up through the rows, the cat picked her way across the floor and jumped up in my lap. I jerked the knitting up and said, "Whoa! Dorothy must have weighed 20 pounds. She turned her backside to me and stuck her tail in the air like a pump handle, exhibiting her little spigot while she marched in place.
She never does that. I don't know what's got into her. Oh, she must like you, Belmira said, turning up cards as she spoke.
I'm thrilled.
Oh, well, would you look at this? The 10 of Wands reversed.
Belle was laying out a reading. She placed the 10 of Wands on the table in some mysterious configuration. The card she'd assigned me, the Page of Swords, had now been covered by the moon. I freed one hand and cranked Dorothy's tail down, securing it with my right arm as I pointed to the cards. Oh, what's that one mean? I thought the moon might be good, but the sisters exchanged a look that made me think otherwise. Cordia said,
I told you she'd do this. The moon stands for hidden enemies, dear. Danger, darkness, and terror. Not too good.
No kidding. She pointed to a card.
The 10 of Wands reversed represents obstacles, difficulties, and intrigues. And this one, the Hanged Man, represents the best you can hope for. She doesn't want to hear that, Belle.
I do. I can handle it.
This card crowns you.
What's that, I'm afraid to ask, I said.
Oh, the Hangman is good. He represents wisdom, trials, sacrifice, intuition, divination, prophecy. This is what you want, but it isn't yours at present. She's trying to help with my knitting. You might at least leave her alone until she finishes.
I can do both, I said, though truthfully Dorothy's presence was making the task difficult. The cat had rotated in my lap and now seemed intent on smelling my breath. She extended her nose daintily. I paused and breathed through my mouth for her. What's that card? I said while she butted my chin with her head.
The Knight of Swords, which is placed at your feet. This is your own, what you have to work with. Skill, bravery, capacity, enmity, wrath, war, destruction.
Oh, the wrath part sounds good.
Not overall, Belle corrected. Overall? You're screwed. You see this one? This card stands for pain, affliction, tears, sadness, desolation.
Well, dang.
Exactly. I'd say you're up Poop Creek without a roll of teepee.
Dorothy climbed up on my chest, purring. She put her face up in mine and we stared at one another. I glanced back at the tarot deck. Even I, believing none of this, could see the trouble I was in. Aside from the Hanged Man, there was a fellow burdened with heavy sticks, yet another fellow face down on the ground with 10 swords protruding from his back. The card for judgment didn't seem to bode well, and then there was the 9 of Wands, which showed a cranky-looking man clinging to a staff, 8 staves in a line behind him. That card was followed by a heart pierced with 3 swords, rain, and clouds above. By then, I'd succeeded in rescuing the lost stitches, and I reached around Dorothy to return the knitting to Cordia. I thought it was time to get down to business, so I asked Cordia what she could tell me about Mickey.
I can't say I know all that much about him. He was extremely private.
He worked as a bank guard until he lost his job in February. I used to see him going out in his uniform. He looked handsome, I must say.
What happened? About what? How'd he lose his job?
He drank. You must have known that if you were married to him. 9 in the morning, he reeked of alcohol. I don't think he drank at that hour. This was left from the night before, fumes pouring through his skin. He never staggered, and I never once heard him slur his words. He wasn't loud or mean. He was always a gentleman, but he was losing ground.
I'm sorry to hear that. I knew he drank, but it's hard to believe he reached a point where drinking interfered with his work. He was a cop in the old days when I was married to him.
Is that right? She said.
Was there anything else you could tell me about him?
He was quiet. No parties. Paid his rent on time until the last few months. No visitors except for that nasty fellow with all the chains.
I turned my attention from Dorothy.
Chains? One of those motorcycle types. Studs and black leather. He had a cowboy mentality, swaggered when he walked. Made so much noise, it sounded like he was wearing spurs.
What was that about?
I have no idea. Dort didn't like him. He was very rude. He knocked her sideways with his foot when she tried to smell his boot.
Belle said,
Oh, dear. This card represents the king of cops. Reversed again. Oh, that's not good.
I looked over with interest. The king of cops?
I didn't say cops, dear. I said cups. The king of cups stands for a dishonest, double-dealing man. Roguery, vice, scandal, oh, you name it.
Belatedly, I felt a flutter of uneasiness. Speaking of which, what made you think I was a cop when I came to the door? Cordia looked up.
Because an officer called this morning and said a detective would be stopping by at 2 this afternoon. We thought it must be you since you were up there so long.
I felt my heart give a little hiccup and I checked my watch. Nearly 2 o'clock now. Gee, I better hit the road and let the two of you get back to work, I said.
I wonder if you could do me a little favor.
Belle turned up the next card and said,
Don't worry about it, dear. We won't mention you were here.
I'd appreciate that.
I'll take you out the other door, Cordia said, so you can reach the alley without being seen. The detectives park in the front. At least they did before.
Why don't I leave you a number? That way you can get in touch with me if anything comes up, I said. I jotted down my number on the back of my business card. In return, Cordia wrote their number on the edge of the rental application. Neither questioned my request. With a tarot like mine, they must have assumed I was going to need help. On the way home, I stopped off at McDonald's and bought myself a QP with cheese, an order of fries, and a medium Coke. Once I'd picked Dorothy's hair off my lip, I steered with one hand while I munched with the other, all the time moaning with pleasure. It's pitiful to have a life in which junk food is awarded the same high status as sex. Then again, I tend to get a lot more of the one than I do of the other. I was back in Santa Teresa by 4:15. The only message on my machine was from Mark Bethel, who'd finally returned my Monday afternoon call at 11:30 Wednesday morning. I dialed his number, taking a moment to unzip my jeans and remove Mickey's mail from my underpants. Naturally, Mark was out, so I ended up talking to Judy.
You almost caught him. He left 15 minutes ago.
Shoot. Well, I'm sorry I missed him. I just got home from Los Angeles. I have news about Mickey, and I may need his help. I'm in for the afternoon. If he has a chance to call back, I'd love to talk to him.
I'm afraid he's gone for the day, Kinsey. But if you like, you can catch him at 7 o'clock tonight at the Lampara,
she said, naming a downtown theater. Doing what? I asked, though I had a fair idea. Mark Bethel was one of 14 Republican candidates who'd be battling it out in the primary coming up on June 3rd, a scant 12 days off. I'd heard 4 of them had been invited to debate the issues at an event being sponsored by the League for Fair Government, or some organization along those lines.
This is a public debate. Robert Naylor, Mike Antonovich, Bobby Fiedler, and Mark talking about election issues.
Oh, sounds hot, I said, thinking who's kidding who. The California Secretary of State, Marchfong Yu, was predicting the lowest voter turnout in 46 years. Of the candidates Judy'd mentioned, only Mike Antonovich, the conservative L.A. County supervisor, had even a slim chance at winning. Naylor was an assemblyman from Menlo Park, the only Northern Californian in the race, until Ed Zhao had stepped in. Zhao was the front-runner. Rumor had it that the San Diego Union, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Contra Costa Times were all coming out in support of him. Meanwhile, Bobby Fiedler, a San Fernando Valley congresswoman and a seasoned politician, had had the rug pulled out from under her when a grand jury indicted her for allegedly bribing another candidate into leaving the race. The charges turned out to be completely groundless and had been dismissed, but her supporters had lost enthusiasm and she was having trouble building momentum again. As for Mark, this was his second fling at a statewide election, and he was busy pouring Laddie's money into TV spots in which he touted himself for running such a clean campaign, like anyone gave a shit. The notion of sitting through some droning political debate was enough to put me in a coma of my own. Meanwhile, Judy was saying, Mark's been preparing for days, mostly on Prop 51, that's the Deep Pockets initiative. Right. Also, Props 42 and 48, he feels pretty strongly about those. I said, hey, who wouldn't? I pushed some papers around my desk, uncovering the sample ballot under the local paper and a pile of mail. Prop 48 was the one about putting a lid on ex-officials' pensions. Yawn, snore. Prop 42 would authorize the state to issue $850 million in bonds to continue the Cal Vet Farm and Home Loan Program. I didn't know Mark was a veteran, I said, making conversation. Oh, sure. He enlisted in the Army right after his college graduation. I'll send you a copy of his CV. You don't have to do that, I said. It's no trouble. I have a bunch of them going out in the mail. You know he won a Purple Heart. Really? I had no idea. While Judy nattered on, I found the comic section and read Rex Morgan, M.D., which was at least as interesting. Judy interrupted herself, saying, Shoot, there goes my other phone. I better catch that in case it's him. No problem. As soon as I hung up, I propped my feet up on the desk and turned my attention to the mail I'd snitched. I picked up my letter opener and slit the envelopes. The bank statement showed regular paycheck deposits until late February, then nothing until late March when he began to make small deposits at bi-weekly intervals. Unemployment benefits? I couldn't remember how that worked. There was probably a waiting period during which claims were processed and approved. In any event, the checks he was receiving weren't sufficient to cover all of his monthly expenses, and he was having to supplement the total out of his savings account. The current balance there was roughly $1,500. I'd found cash hidden on the premises, but no sign of his passbook. It would be nice to have that. I was surprised I hadn't come across it in my initial search. The monthly statements would have to do. By comparing the activity in his savings and checking accounts, I could see the money jump from one to the other and then slide on out the door. Canceled checks indicated that he'd continued to pay as many bills as he could. His rent was $850 a month, the last of which had been paid March 1st, according to the canceled check. Through the last half of February and the first 3 weeks of March, there were three checks made out to cash, totaling $1,800. That seemed odd, given his financial difficulties, which were serious enough without pissing away his cash. The police probably had the April statement, so there was no way for me to tell if he'd paid rent on the first or not. My guess was that sometime in here he'd let his storage fees become delinquent. By April, he was already in arrears on his telephone bill, and his service must have been cut before he had a chance to catch up. The cash he'd hidden probably represented a last resort, monies he was reluctant to spend unless his situation became desperate. Maybe his intent was to disappear once all his other funds were depleted. On the 25th of March, there was a one-time deposit of $900. I decided that was probably from the sale of his car. A couple of days later, on the 27th, there was a modest deposit of $200, which allowed him to pay his gas and electric bills.
I did note that the $200 appeared the very day the call was made from his apartment to my machine. Someone paid him to use the phone? That would be weird. At any rate, he probably figured he could stall eviction for another month or two, at which point, what? He'd take his cash and his various phony documents and leave the state? Something about this gnawed at me. Mickey was a fanatic about savings. It was his contention that everyone should have a good 6 months' worth of income in the bank, or under the mattress, whichever seems safer. He was such a nut on the subject, I'd made it a practice myself since then. He had to have another savings account somewhere. Had he put the money in a CD or a pension fund at his job? I wasn't even sure why he'd been fired. Was he drunk on duty? I sat and thought about that and then called directory assistance in Los Angeles and got the number for Pacific Coast Security in Culver City. I figured I had sufficient information to fake my way through. I knew his date of birth and his current address. His social security number would have been an asset, but all I remembered of it was the last four digits, 1776. Mickey always made a point about the numbers being the same as the year the Declaration of Independence was signed. I dialed the number for Pacific Coast Security and listened to the phone ring, trying to figure out what I was going to say. Surely not the truth in this case. When the call was picked up, I asked for personnel. The woman who answered sounded like she was already halfway home for the day. It was now close to 5, and she was probably in the process of clearing her desk.
"This is personnel, Mrs. Bird," she said.
"Oh, hi. This is Mrs. Weston in the billing department at UCLA Medical Center. We're calling with regard to a patient who's been admitted to ICU. We understand he's employed by Pacific Coast Security, and we're wondering if you can verify his insurance coverage."
"Certainly," she said. "The employee's name?"
"The last name, Magruder, that's Magruder. First name, Mickey. You may have him listed as Michael. Middle initial, B. Home address, 2805 Sepulveda Boulevard. Date of birth, 16 September 1933. Admitted through emergency on May 14. We don't have a complete social security number, but we'd love to pick that up from you." I could hear the woman breathing in my ear.
"We heard about that. The poor man. Unfortunately, like I told the detectives, Mr. Magruder no longer works for us. He was terminated as of February 28th.
"Terminated as in fired?"
"That's right."
"Well, for heaven's sake, what for?" She paused.
"I'm not at liberty to discuss that, but it had to do with D-R-I-N-K-I-N-G.
"That's too bad. What about his medical insurance? Is there any possibility his coverage was extended?"
"Not according to our records."
"Well, that's odd. He had an insurance card in his wallet when he was brought in, and we were under the impression his coverage was current. Is he employed by any other company in the area?"
"I doubt it. We haven't been asked for references."
"What about unemployment? Has he applied for benefits? Because he may qualify for medical under SDI. "Yeah, right. SDI. Like we were all so casual about state disability insurance, we didn't even need to spell it out."
"I really can't answer that. You'd have to check with them."
"What about money in his pension fund? Did he have automatic debits to his savings out of each paycheck?"
"I don't see where that's relevant," she said.
She was beginning to sound alarmed, probably wondering if this was a ruse of some kind.
"You would if you saw the way his bill was mounting up," I said tartly.
"I'm afraid I can't discuss it, especially with the police involved. They made a big point of that. We're not supposed to talk to anyone about anything when it comes to him."
"Same here. We've been asked to notify Detective Aldo if anyone even asks for his room."
"Really? They didn't say anything like that to us. Maybe because he hadn't worked here for so long."
"Oh, consider yourself lucky. We're on red alert. Did you know Mr. Magruder personally?"
"Sure. The company's not all that big."
"You must feel terrible."
"I do. He's a real sweet guy. I can't imagine why anyone would want to do that to him."
"Awful," I said. "What about his social security number? We have the last four digits, 1776.
But the emergency room clerk couldn't understand what he was saying, so she missed the first portion. All I need are the first 5 digits for our records. The director's a real stickler. She seemed startled.
He was conscious?
Oh, well, I don't know, now you mention it. He must have been, at least briefly. How else would we have this much? I sensed her debate. It's in his best interest, I added piously.
Just a minute.
I heard her clicking her computer keys, and after a moment she read off the first 5 digits. I made a note. Thanks, you're a doll. I appreciate that. There was a pause, and then her curiosity got the better of her.
How's he doing?
I'm sorry, but I'm not allowed to divulge that information. You'd have to ask the medical staff. I'm sure you can appreciate the confidentiality of these matters, especially here at UCLA.
Of course, absolutely. Well, I hope he's okay. Tell him Ingrid said hi.
I'll pass the word. Time for clerical work. I opened my desk drawer and took out a fresh pack of lined index cards. I began jotting down notes, writing as fast as I could, one item per card, piling them up as I went. I had a lot of catching up to do, days of accumulated questions. I knew some of the answers, but most of the lines I was forced to leave blank. I used to imagine I could hold it all in my head. But memory has a way of pruning and deleting, eliminating anything that doesn't seem relevant in the moment. Later, it's the odd, unrelated detail that sometimes makes the puzzle parts rearrange themselves like magic. The very act of taking pen to paper somehow gooses the brain into making the leap. It doesn't always happen in the moment, but without the concrete notation, the data disappears. I checked my watch. It was 6:05, and I was so cockeyed with weariness my clothes had begun to hurt. I turned the ringer off the phone, went up the spiral stairs, stripped, kicked my shoes off, wrapped myself in a quilt, and slept. I woke at 9:15, though it felt like midnight. I sat up in bed, yawning, and tried to get my bearings. I felt weighted with weariness. I pushed the covers aside and went over to the railing. Below, on my desk, I could see the light on my answering machine blinking merrily. Shit. If not for that, I'd have crawled back in bed and slept on through till morning. I pulled a robe on and picked my way down the stairs barefoot. I pressed play and listened to a message from Cordia Hatfield, the manager of Mickey's building.
Kinsey, I wonder if you could give us a call when you come in. There's something we think you should be aware of.
She'd called at 8:45, so I felt it was probably safe to return the call. I dialed the number and Cordia picked up before I'd even heard the phone ring once.
Hello?
Cordia, is that you? This is Kinsey Milhone up in Santa Teresa. The phone didn't even ring.
Well, it did down here. Listen, dear, the reason I called is that detective stopped by shortly after you left. He spent quite a bit of time up 2H, and when he finished, he came right back down. He seemed perturbed, and he asked if anyone had gone in. We played dumb. He was quite insistent, but neither of us breathed a word.
Ah, was this the tall, dark guy, Detective Aldo?
That's the one. We're old. What do we know, what with all our brain cells gone? We didn't lie to him exactly, but I'm afraid we did skirt the truth a bit. I said I'm perfectly capable of taking in rent checks and calling the plumber if a toilet backs up, but I don't go skulking around spying on the tenants. What they do is their business. Then I showed him my foot and told him, with this bunion, I'm lucky to get around. I can't be tromping up and down. He changed the subject after that.
What set him off? Did he say anything about that?
He said something was missing, though he wouldn't say what. He had a box load of items with him and told me he'd remove the crime tape. For all the good it did, is how he put it. He was sour on the subject, I can tell you that.
Thanks for the warning.
You're entirely welcome. Main reason I called is you're free to go in, but it won't be long. The owners are pressing to get Mr. Magruder out of there. I guess the detective notified the management company, so they know he's in a coma. They snapped right to it, taking advantage of his condition. Shame on them. Anyway, if you're interested in renting, you should take a look.
I may do that. I'd like that. When would be good?
The sooner, the better. You're only 2 hours away.
You're talking about tonight?
I think you'd be smart. The owners have already served him with a 3-day pay or quit, so technically the sheriff could have a new lock on the door by tomorrow morning.
Well, can't we do something to prevent that?
Not as far as I know.
What if I pay what he owes plus the next month's rent? Wouldn't that cancel the action?
I doubt it. Once a tenant starts paying late or doesn't pay at all, the owners would just as soon clear the place out and get someone else in.
I thought about the drive, rolling my eyes with dismay. I wish I'd known this when I was down there earlier.
If you're coming, you best hurry. It's entirely up to you, of course.
Cordia, it's already close to 9:30. If I come down tonight, I'd still have to pack and get gas, which means I probably won't arrive before midnight. I didn't mention I was close to naked.
Oh, that's not late for us. Belle and I only need 4 hours sleep, so we're up till all hours. The advantage in coming now is you'd have all the time you want and not a soul to disturb you.
Mickey's neighbors won't notice if his lights are on?
Nobody pays attention. Most of these folks work, so they're usually in bed by 10. And if it gets too late, you can always spend the night with us. We have the only 3-bedroom unit in the building. The guest room is really Dord's, but I'm sure she wouldn't mind the company.
We had quite a little chat about you after you left. I let go of my resistance and took a deep breath. All right, I'll do it. See you in a bit. As soon as I hung up, I changed into my jeans, turtleneck, and tennis shoes, which were light and silent, good for late-night work. At least I'd been inside Mickey's place and knew what to expect. I still had the key I'd removed from his back door, but I intended to take my pick in case the need arose. Since I had no intention of driving home in the wee hours of the morning, I threw in the oversized T-shirt I wear as a nightie. I routinely carry a toothbrush, toothpaste, and fresh underwear in the bottom of my shoulder bag. The rest of the duffel I filled with tools, rubber gloves, my battery-operated pick, drill and drill bits, screwdriver, light bulbs, pliers, needle-nose pliers, magnifying glass, and dental mirror, along with 2 flashlights, one standard and one on a long stem that could be angled for viewing those hard-to-reach places Mickey loved so much. I suspected I'd uncovered the majority of his hiding places, but I didn't want to take the chance, especially since this represented my last opportunity to snoop. I also packed a 2nd canvas duffel bag, folded and placed inside the first. I planned to confiscate Mickey's contraband and hold it at my place until he could let me know what he wanted done with it. I stopped at a service station to have my gas tank filled. While the guy cleaned the windshield and checked the oil, I popped into the refreshment center and bought myself a big, nasty sandwich, cheese and mystery meat, and a large styrofoam container of coffee that smelled only faintly scorched. I bought a separate carton of milk, poured out some of the black liquid, and refilled the cup to the brim with milk, then added 2 paper packets of sugar just to make sure my brain would be properly abuzz. I was on my way by 10:10. The VW windows rolled down, the engine whining with the effort of maintaining a constant 60 miles per hour. I ate as I drove and somehow avoided spilling coffee down my front. There were a surprising number of cars on the road, interspersed with semis and RVs, all of us traveling at breakneck speeds. The sense of urgency was multiplied by the darkness that encompassed us, headlights and taillights forming ever-shifting patterns. In the stretch between Santa Teresa and Olvidado, the moon sat above the water like an alabaster globe resting on a silver pyramid. Along the shoreline, the waves were like loosely churning pearls, tumbling through the surf. The ancient scent of seaweed drifted in the night air like a mist. Seaside communities appeared and disappeared as the miles accumulated. Hillsides, visible in the distance by day, were reduced to pinpoints of light that wound along the slopes. I crested the Camarillo grade and coasted down the far side into the westernmost perimeter of the San Fernando Valley. There were no stars in sight. The Los Angeles light pollution gave the night sky a ghostly illumination, like an aurora borealis underlaid by smog.
I cut south on the 405 as far as National and then drove east. At Sepulveda, I hung a left and slowed, looking for Mickey's building in the unfamiliar night landscape. I parked out on the street, taking my shoulder bag and duffel. I locked the car behind me and prayed that the chassis, the wheels, and the engine wouldn't be dismantled and missing by morning. The lights were on in the Hatfields' kitchen. I tapped at the door and Cordia let me in. Belle was sleeping upright in her chair, so Cordia and I had a whispered conversation while she showed me the guest room with its adjoining bath. Dorothy followed like a puppy cat, making sure she was in the center of any ongoing discussion. I had to pause more than once to rub behind her ears. I tossed my shoulder bag on the bed. Dorothy promptly claimed ownership, using all 20 pounds to squish and flatten the contents. The last I saw, she had settled like a chicken on a nest full of eggs. I went up the front stairs, along the gallery, lighting my way with the larger of my flashlights. The two apartments I passed were shrouded in darkness, the sliding glass windows open into what I was guessing were bedrooms. I continued around the corner where I let myself into Mickey's back door, using the key I'd lifted. I debated about leaving the door locked or unlocked and decided to leave it locked. Ordinarily, I'd have opted to leave the door ajar in case I had to make a hasty exit, but I was feeling anxious and didn't like the possibility of someone coming in on me. I moved through the apartment to the living room. The only light was a thin shaft coming in from the gallery between drapery panels in the dining ell. I shone the flashlight beam like a sword, cutting through the shadows. Since I'd been here earlier, the fingerprint technician had been busy with his brushes, leaving powder residue on countless surfaces. I made a quick foray through the dining area and kitchen, then back through the bedroom and bathroom to make sure I was alone. I returned to the living room and secured the openings between the drapes. I pulled on my rubber gloves. Despite the fact the cops had come and gone, I didn't want to leave evidence that I had been in the place. I like to think I had learned something from my little trip through Ted Rich's doggy door. I turned on the overhead light, pausing to swap Mickey's 60-watt bulb for one of the 200-watt bulbs I'd brought with me. Even a cursory glance showed Detective Aldo had been there. Kitchen cabinets were standing open. All the mail was missing, and the fishbowl full of matches had been upended on the dining room table. I pictured the police sorting through the collection for clues, carefully making notes about the bars and restaurants Mickey'd frequented. In truth, only about half the matchbooks would be from the places he'd been. The rest were packets other people had acquired for him while traveling, a practice left over from his youth when he'd assembled hundreds of such covers and mounted them in albums. Who knows why kids like to do shit like that? I got down to work, methodically emptying the miniature safes he'd created behind the electrical plates. The three sets of phony IDs, credit cards, and the currency went in my duffel. I spent a long time in his kitchen, sorting through containers with a fine-tooth comb, checking in and behind and under drawers. Once again, I removed the 5-gallon water bottles from under the sink, unscrewed the back panel. This time, I lifted out the handguns from the racks he'd built and put them in my duffel with the IDs. I went into the bedroom and took the chenille bedspread and sheets off his bed. Tacky little thing that I am, I paused to check for evidence of recent sexual excess, but found none. I pulled off the mattress and checked it carefully, looking for evidence that he'd opened a seam and restitched it. Good theory, no deal. I lay on my back and hunched my way under the bed, where I peeled back the gauzy material that covered the bottom of his box springs. I shone the flashlight across the underside, but no dice. I put the mattress back in place and then remade the bed. This was worse than hotel work, which I had also done in my day. I crawled the entire perimeter of wall-to-wall carpeting, pulling up section after section without finding much except a centipede that scared the hell out of me. I tried the bed table drawer. The diaphragm was gone, as was the bottle of cologne and the tissue paper packet with the enameled heart and gold chain. Well, well, well. His latest enamorata must have heard about the shooting. She was certainly quick to erase the signs of their relationship. She must have had a key of her own, letting herself in sometime between my initial visit and this one. Could she be someone in the building? That was a notion worth exploring. I spent a good 30 minutes in the bathroom where I lifted the lid to the toilet tank and used my dental mirror and the angled flashlight to check for items concealed behind it. Nothing. I took all the toiletries out of the medicine cabinet and lifted the entire cabinet off the wall brackets to see if he'd hollowed out a space in the wall behind it. Nope. I checked inside the shower rod, checked the cheap-looking vanity for false fronts or concealed panels. I unscrewed the heater vent, tapped along the baseboards, listening for hollow spots. I removed the PVC under the bathroom sink. The gold coins were still there. I loaded those in my duffel and replaced the length of pipe. No telling what the next tenant would make of it if the fake plumbing were discovered at some future date. In the hollow core of the toilet paper roll, I found a $100 bill. I went through his closet, checking his pockets, looking behind the hanging row of clothes, for the possibility of a false wall at the rear. Nothing. The numerous zippered pockets in the black leather jacket were all empty. At the back of the closet, I found his answering machine, which he'd probably unplugged once his phone service was disconnected or no longer in service. I opened the lid, but the cops had apparently taken the tape. I found one additional stash behind the closet switchplate. In a narrow slot that ran back along a stud, Mickey'd tucked a sealed number 10 envelope. I put it in my duffel for later scrutiny. I had one other cache to unload that I'd saved until last. I went back into the living room where I turned off the overhead light. I moved from window to window, looking out at the dark. It was 2:30 in the morning, and for the most part, windows in neighboring buildings were black. Occasionally, I would see a light on, but the drapes would be drawn and no one was peeking through the slit. I picked up no movement in the immediate vicinity. Traffic noises had all but died. I unhooked the two sets of drapes and lifted down the rods. I removed the finials and flashed a light down into the hollow core and removed the cache. I replaced the rods and rehung the drapes, moving with a sudden sense of anxiety. I lifted my head. Had I heard something? Maybe the removal of the crime tape was done to tempt me, and Detective Alda was outside waiting. He'd be thrilled to catch me with the duffel load of burglar tools, the handguns, and phony documents. I kept the overhead light off, restricting myself to the use of my penlight as I went through the apartment, quickly gathering my tools, checking to see that I'd left no personal traces. The whole time I had the feeling I'd overlooked something obvious, but I knew I'd be pushing my luck to go back and try to figure it out. I was so focused on escape that I came close to missing the crunch of cinders and the putter of a motorcycle as it glided to a stop in the alley. Belatedly, I realized I'd picked up the muted roar as the motorcycle passed along the street out in front. The rider must have cut the switch at the entrance to the alley, coasting the rest of the way. I went over to the rear window and opened the drapes a crack. From that angle, I couldn't see much, but I was relatively certain someone was moving along the alley. I closed my eyes and listened. Within 30 seconds, I could hear the chink of boots on the stair treads, accompanied by a jingle as each step was mounted. The guy was coming up the back way, possibly a tenant or a neighbor. I turned off my flashlight and followed the guy's progress by sound as he rounded the gallery along the back of the building and came up to Mickey's front door. I had hoped to hear him pass. Instead, I heard a tap and a hoarse whispering.
"Hey, Mr. Magruder! Open up. It's me."
I passed through Mickey's bedroom and headed for the rear door, fumbling in my jeans for the key. My hand was steady, but every other part of me was shaking so hard I couldn't hit the keyhole. I was afraid to use my flashlight because the guy had now moved to Mickey's bedroom window where the tapping became sharper, a harsh clicking as though he might be rapping on the glass with a ring.
"Open the fuck up and get your ass out here."
He had moved the few steps to the front door where he began to knock again. This time, the pounding was of a fee-fi-fo-fum variety and seemed to shake the intervening walls. The next-door neighbor, whose bedroom must have been contiguous with Mickey's, yelled out his window,
"Shut up, you prick! We're trying to sleep in here!"
The guy at the door said something even worse than the F-word, which I won't repeat. I could hear him jingle his way toward the neighbor's bedroom window where I pictured him bashing through the glass with his fist. Sure enough, I heard the impact of his blow and the subsequent tinkling of glass, followed by a startled yelp from the tenant. I took advantage of this tender hallmark moment to shine a quick light on the keyhole. I turned the key in the lock, and I was almost out the door when I stopped in my tracks. I'd never get in again. By morning, the sheriff's deputy would arrive and the locks would be changed. While I could probably pick my way in again, I didn't want to take the risk. Now that all the stashes had been cleaned out, there was only one thing of value. I set down the two duffels and returned to Mickey's closet, where I lifted the leather jacket from its hanger and shrugged myself into it. I heard a second window break. I grabbed the two duffels and eased out the back door, barely pausing long enough to lock it behind me. I was halfway down the back stairs when a face appeared above me. Over the wrought iron railing, I saw shaggy corn-yellow hair, a long, bony face, narrow shoulders, and a sunken chest in a blue denim jacket with the sleeves cut out. I slung one duffel over my shoulder and hugged the other to my body. I began to bound down the stairs, taking them two at a time, while the guy in the jacket was making his way to the landing. I reached the bottom of the stairs at the same moment he started down. I could hear every step he took because of the jingling on his boots, which must have been decorated with chains. I ran on tiptoe, keeping wide on the outside, conscious to avoid knocking into the water meters near the building. The manager's apartment was fully dark by now, but Cordia, as promised, had left the back door unlocked. I turned the knob and opened the door to let myself in. My entrance was delayed briefly when the duffel over my shoulder got hung up on the doorframe. I jerked it free and flung both duffels into the room. I was just turning to close the door when Dorothy streaked out through the narrow opening. She must have come running to see what I was up to, and then she couldn't resist making a bid for freedom. Once out, she stopped, astonished to find herself alone in the chilly dark at that hour. I heard a thumping noise and a resounding curse. The guy must have caught a foot on a water meter and gone down sprawling. I could hear him cussing as he recovered his gait and came limping down on us in a towering rage. If he caught up with Dorothy, he was going to wring her neck and fling her over the fence, thus forcing her return to this life as some other form. I grabbed her by the tail and dragged her backward while she struggled to gain purchase on the concrete with her outstretched claws. I hauled her up, squawking, into the dark of the kitchen, closed the door, and bolted it in one motion. I sank down on the floor, clutching her against me while my heart kept on banging and my breath came in gasps. I heard the jingling footsteps approach and come to a halt outside the Hatfields' door. The guy kicked the door hard enough to hurt himself. He must have had a flashlight with him because a beam was soon being played across the far wall, briefly raking the kitchen table. The wand of light streaked back and forth. At one point, I could tell he'd angled up on tiptoe, trying to shine the light down on the darkened area where I was crouched. Meanwhile, Dorothy strained against my embrace and finally managed to wiggle free. I lunged, but she eluded me. She gave me a cranky look and then made a point of sashaying toward the dining room so that her path took her directly through his beam of light. There was a long, labored silence. I thought he'd break the door down, but he must have thought better of it. Finally, I heard the scritch and jingle of his boots as they receded along the walkway. I slumped against the door, waiting to hear his motorcycle start up and go screaming away in the night. Oh, there was no such reassuring sound. I finally staggered to my feet, retrieved the two duffels, and crept through the dining room toward the guest room. The nightlight in the hallway illuminated my way. The two other bedroom doors were closed, Cordia and Belmyra having slept through the uproar and the enveloping silence of poor hearing. Once in the guest room, I kicked my shoes off and laid down on the bed, still wearing Mickey's jacket. Dorothy was already on the bed. The pillow turned out to be hers, so I wasn't allowed the full use of it, just a few paltry inches around the edges. The still indignant cat now felt compelled to wash from head to toe, comforting herself after the insult of having her tail pulled so rudely. The bedroom curtains were closed, but I found myself staring at them, fearful a fist would come smashing through the glass. Dorothy's steady licking took on a restful quality. The warmth of my body activated Mickey's personal scent from the lining of the jacket. Cigarette smoke and aqua velva. I stopped shivering and eventually fell asleep, with Dorothy's dainty feet resting neatly in my hair. I woke to the smell of coffee. I was still wearing Mickey's jacket, but someone had placed a heavy afghan across my legs. I put a hand above my head, feeling across the pillow, but Dorothy was gone. The door was open a crack. Sunlight made the curtains glow. I looked at my watch and saw that it was close to 8. I put my feet over the side of the bed and ran a hand through my hair, yawning. I was getting too old to horse around at all hours of the night. I went into the bathroom and brushed my teeth and showered and dressed again. In the end, I looked much as I had when I had arrived. Belmyra was sitting at the kitchen table watching a talk show when I finally made my appearance. She was a tiny thing, quite thin, so short her feet barely touched the floor. Today she wore a white bib apron over a red and white print house dress. She was shelling peas, a colander in her lap, a paper bag sitting next to her with the rim folded back. Dorothy was on the counter licking butter from the butter dish. Belle smiled at me shyly.
"Coffee's over there," she said. "The sheriff's deputy just arrived with the locksmith, so Cordia went upstairs to let them in. Did you sleep well?"
I didn't get enough of it, but what I had was fine. I crossed to the coffee pot, an old-fashioned percolator sitting on the stove. There was a mug on the counter along with a carton of milk. I poured a cup and added milk.
"Would you like to have an egg? We have cereal, too. Cordy made some oatmeal with raisins. That's what we have. Brown sugar's in the canister if you want to help yourself."
I think I better go on up and see if I can catch Mickey's neighbors before they go off to work. I can always have breakfast once the deputy's gone. At the door, I looked back. Did she say anything about a motorcycle parked in the alley? Belmyra shook her head. I took my coffee mug with me and headed for the stairs. I could see the sheriff's patrol car parked at the curb, not far from my VW, which, as far as I could tell, was still intact. The day was sunny and cool, the air already fragrant with the morning's accumulation of exhaust fumes. I passed along the second-floor gallery. A few neighbors had gathered to watch the locksmith at work. Maybe for them this was a cautionary tale about paying the rent on time. Most seemed dressed for work, except for one woman in robe and slippers who'd brought her morning coffee with her. Like rubberneckers passing a highway accident, they looked on, both repelled and attracted by the sight of someone else's misfortune. This was all faintly reminiscent of the fires that burned across the Santa Teresa foothills back in 1964. During the long, smoky evenings, people would gather on the street in clusters, sipping beer and chatting while the flames danced across the distant mountains. The presence of catastrophe seemed to break down the usual social barriers until the atmosphere was nearly festive. Cordia Hatfield was keeping a careful eye on the situation, standing in the open doorway with a white sweater thrown over her shoulders. Her oversized blue and white checked house dress was worn ankle length, and she sported the same pair of slippers with her bunion peeking out. She turned as I approached.
"I see you found the coffee. How'd you sleep last night?"
Dorothy was stingy with the pillow, but aside from that, I did great.
"She was never one to share. Even when she came back, she insisted on having her old room to herself. We were going to keep it closed up for guests, but she refused to use the litter box until she got her way."
Mickey's immediate neighbor, who appeared to be somewhere in his 40s, emerged from his apartment pulling on a tweed sport coat over a royal blue Superman t-shirt. His shiny brown hair extended to his waist. He wore large metal-framed glasses with yellow lenses. A mustache and a closely trimmed beard bracketed a full complement of white teeth. His jeans were ripped and faded, and his cowboy boots had 3-inch platform soles. Behind him, I could see the broken bedroom window, patched together now with cardboard and a jagged bolt of silver duct tape. He said,
"Hey, Miss Hatfield, how are you today?"
She said,
"Morning. Just dandy. What happened to your window? That'll have to be repaired."
"Sorry about that. I'll take care of it. I called a glass company on Olympic, and they said they'd be out to take a look. Has Mickey been evicted?
I'm afraid so, she said.
The deputy clearly wasn't needed, so he returned to his car and went about his business. The locksmith beckoned to Cordia. She excused herself, and the two of them moved inside to have a consultation. The next-door neighbor had paused to watch the proceedings, and he now greeted a couple who came out of the third apartment on that side. Both were dressed for work. The woman murmured something to her husband, and the two continued toward the stairs. Mickey's neighbor nodded politely in my direction, acknowledging my presence. I murmured, "Hi, how are you?"
"Good, thanks. Oh, what kind of crap is this? This dude's in a coma and they're changing the locks on him?"
"I guess the owners are pretty hard-nosed."
"They'd have to be," he said. "So, how's Mickey doing? You a friend of his?"
"You could say that, I guess. We used to be married."
"No shit. When was this?"
"Early 70s. Didn't last long. I'm Kinsey, by the way, and you're
Ware Beeson," he said. "Everybody calls me Wary."